and options with technical experts, and trying every means available to persuade foreign creditors for assistance, Mawad paid less attention to his political colleagues and to the people on the streets and in the villages. In retrospect, he might have let his technical experts in the ministries do all of the technical work so that he could focus heavily on the political and adaptive work. Instead, looking back at his weekly calendar, Mawad realized he had spent more than 65% of his time working in a technical problem-solving mode, and less than 35% of his time working with the politicians and public groups with direct stakes in the situation. Rather than using every day as an opportunity to be a visible champion to his people, to provide hope and to explain the process and pains of modernization in a globalizing economy, he devoted most of his time to searching for the right policy solution and then attempting to get the people to be reasonable in accepting the necessary technical fixes. Although he recognized the adaptive challenges, he hoped to find a short-term remedy that would give him time to deal with them. Clearly, the odds were badly stacked against him. But when you focus your energy primarily on the technical aspects of complex challenges, you do opt for short-term rewards. Sometimes by doing so, you might strategically buy some time to deal with the adaptive elements, but you might use up precious time and find yourself, like Mawad, running out of it anyway. In a far less demanding crisis, you may make people happy for a while, but over time you risk your credibility and perhaps your job. Reality may catch up with you as people discover that they are unprepared for the world in which they now live. And though they ought to blame themselves for sticking their heads in the sand and pressuring you to sanction their behavior, it's much more likely they'll blame you. When you are in a position of authority, there are also strong internal pressures to focus on the technical aspects of problems. Most of us take pride in our ability to answer the tough questions that are thrown our way. We get rewarded for bearing people's uncertainty and want to be seen in a competent, heroic light. We like the feeling of stepping up to the plate and having the crowds cheer us on. Yet raising questions that go to the core of people's habits goes unrewarded, at least for a while. You get booed instead of cheered. In fact, it may be a long time before you hear any applause, if ever. They may throw tomatoes. They may shoot bullets. Leadership takes the capacity to stomach hostility so that you can stay connected to people, lest you disengage from them and exacerbate the danger. There is nothing trivial about solving technical problems. Medical personnel save lives every day in the emergency room through their authoritative expertise because they have the right procedures, the right norms, and the right knowledge. Through our managerial know-how, we produce an economy full of products and services, many of them crucial to our daily lives. What makes a problem technical is not that it is trivial, but simply that its solution already lies within the organization's repertoire. In contrast, adaptive pressures force the organization to change, lest it decline. In the 21st century, people and organizations face adaptive pressures every day, in their individual lives and at all levels of society. And each leadership opportunity to respond to these challenges also carries with it attendant risks. For example, when your car breaks down, you go to a mechanic. Most of the time, the mechanic can fix it. However, if the car breaks down because of the way members of the family use it, the problem will probably happen again. The mechanic might be able to get the car on the road once more, but by continuing to deal with it as a purely technical problem a mechanic can solve, the family may end up avoiding the underlying issues, demanding adaptive work, such as how to persuade the mother to stop drinking and driving, or the grandfather to give up his driver's license, or the teenagers to be more cautious. No doubt any family member would find it difficult and risky to step forward and lead the prickly conversations with the mother, grandfather, or even the teenage driver. The terrorism of September 11, 2001, brought home to the United States an adaptive challenge that has been festering for a very long time. With the unthinkable destruction of the World Trade Center, Americans felt a new vulnerability. In response, the initial tendency of the U.S. government was to reduce terrorism to a technical problem of security systems, military and police operations, and criminal justice. But terrorism represents an adaptive challenge to our civil liberties, our mindset of invulnerability, and our capacity to narrow the divide between Christian West and Muslim East that began with the Crusades 1,000 years ago. Should we trust government officials with information that we consider private in the interest of our collective security? Can we accept the undeniable reality that we live in an interdependent world in which safety must primarily be found in the health of our relationships with very different cultures? Can we refashion the religious arrogance that leads people to equate their faith in God with the singular belief that they know God's truth better than anyone else, and that their mission, then, is to capture the market for people's souls? Nearly everyone in the United States has the opportunity to exercise leadership in this adaptive context, yet there will be personal dangers in raising the more difficult questions, some of which, like religious triumphalism, go to the root of religious loyalty and dogma. Going beyond your authority. People rarely elect or hire anyone to disturb their jobs or their lives. People expect politicians and managers to use their authority to provide them with the right answers, not to confront them with disturbing questions and difficult choices. That's why the initial challenge and risk of exercising leadership is to go beyond your authority, to put your credibility and position on the line in order to get people to tackle the problems at hand. Without the willingness to challenge people's expectations of you, there is no way you can escape being dominated by the social system and its inherent limits. Generally, people will not authorize someone to make them face what they do not want to face. Instead, people hire someone to provide protection and ensure stability, someone with solutions that require a minimum of disruption. But adaptive work creates risk, conflict, and instability, because addressing the issues underlying adaptive problems may involve upending deep and entrenched norms. Thus, leadership requires disturbing people, but at a rate they can absorb. Typically, a company faces adaptive pressures when new market conditions threaten the company's business. For example, in the last decade of the 20th century, innovators in IBM attempted to get the company to wake up to the real threats from small computers running what soon came to be called the Internet. And the innovators in IBM repeatedly found themselves in Lois's position when she tried to get her community to face up to alcoholism. Their efforts illustrate the perseverance required of leadership until a successful adaptation can take hold. As an established corporate giant, IBM in 1994 was a master of technical problem solving. The corporation embodied technical proficiency and served as the official technology sponsor of the 1994 Winter Olympics. IBM kept track of the many winter sports competitors, competition areas, timings, and standings that were scattered over a wide expanse in Norway. IBM understandably wanted to protect its position in the technical areas in which IBM managers excelled. When the sports standings were reported on television, viewers saw the IBM logo on their screens. This was smart problem solving within the business areas that IBM managers understood well: sports, television, and marketing. Corporate buyers of IBM mainframe systems who watched the Olympics on television probably appreciated the appearance of the IBM logo. But the markets were changing, and business was migrating to the Internet. The companies that did not adapt fast enough would fail. Some dark clouds were hovering over IBM's technological successes in the Olympics, The corporation had suffered $15 billion in losses over the prior 3 years, reflecting problems in many of their product lines. The financial setbacks made people at IBM vulnerable and even more risk-averse than usual. Moreover, they were culturally and emotionally unprepared to make the big leap to the internet world. The underlying value structure of the organization as a whole was characterized by a smug parochialism, coupled with a resistance to early entry into new markets. Nothing less than the IBM culture and underlying corporate values had to change in order to succeed in the internet environment. Watching the Olympics at home, near his office at Cornell University's Theory Center, a young IBM Corporation engineer named David Grossman discovered that an enterprising website had intercepted the IBM feed to the television networks, diverted the information to the internet, and was displaying IBM's tabulations under the Sun Microsystems Incorporated logo. Grossman was shocked, and IBM didn't have a clue, he recalled. As he soon discovered, the problem, like many tough problems, contained both technical and adaptive elements. After his effort to get managers to understand the technical parts of the problem, IBM attorneys sent Sun Microsystems a letter demanding that Sun stop displaying the IBM data on the Sun site. That effort to protect IBM's work product was resolved with IBM's existing legal and technical expertise. At the same time, as Grossman pushed IBM managers to deal with the business that the internet would continue to grab from IBM, he uncovered values and lifetime habits that were unrealistic and dysfunctional in the internet age. These beliefs about how the business world worked kept IBM from dealing with the reality of the new market challenge. The internet provided an entirely new channel for marketing products and a vehicle for a raft of potential new products and services, such as consulting services to existing clients on internet applications and new internet-friendly software. The speed of change was faster than any of the senior managers had ever witnessed in their long careers. It was as if IBM were depending on continued strong sales of first-rate buggy whips while the automobile was right around the corner. The company was so behind the curve that Grossman could not even find a way to use IBM's primitive email system to send the IBM marketing staff in Norway the screenshots from Sun's website as he watched the piracy during the Winter Games. Luckily, some IBM managers grasped enough of the reality of the problem to come to Grossman's aid when he made his arguments. In particular, John Patrick, who had managed the marketing of the IBM ThinkPad laptop, proceeded to secure for Grossman and other innovators the attention they would need to shift the outmoded values and habits in the IBM corporate culture. Grossman and Patrick led a struggle inside the company that lasted for 5 years. Just prior to the new millennium, IBM managers emerged as a team with revamped values, more flexible beliefs, and new behavior patterns designed to make IBM a proactive force in an internet world. The change was profound and deep. IBM had a reputation for being a bureaucratic dinosaur, but by 1999, Lou Gerstner, CEO of IBM, could trumpet hard figures on the 5-year IBM restructuring to Wall Street investors. Gerstner could show that IBM was a highly profitable internet company, with internal operations, business processes, and customer responses that compared favorably with even the most innovative of internet corporations. Approximately 1/4 of its $82 billion in revenues was now internet-related. The demonstration of the culture change in IBM was so convincing that IBM stock shot up 20 points. Rather than frame the internet as a technical challenge for IBM's experts, Grossman and Patrick presented it as a cultural and values problem that IBM had neglected when it broke into smaller, more manageable departments. CEO Gerstner described the work this way: we discovered what every large company has. When you bring your company to the web, you expose all the inefficiency that comes from decentralized organizations. As middle managers, Grossman and Patrick had the authority to direct only those few who reported to them. And even then, they could not order their employees to act against company policy. They each also reported to a boss. Both Grossman and Patrick went beyond their authority when progress required it. Patrick said, "If you don't occasionally exceed your formal authority, you are not pushing the envelope." As a lowly engineer, Grossman went around the chain of command, taking the risk of being obnoxious and putting himself on the line in danger of ridicule. Once, he barged into the Armonk, New York, IBM corporate headquarters, alone but for a Unix computer under his arm, to introduce the senior executive in marketing, Abby Konstam, to the Internet. In the same vein, Patrick saw at an early Internet trade show how much difference it made to have the biggest space in the display. So he committed IBM for the biggest display space in the next year's show, even though it was not his job to make that decision alone. However, if he had waited for the IBM bureaucracy to set aside the money and give him the authorization, the display space auction would have closed and the opportunity would have been missed. To act outside the narrow confines of your job description, when progress requires it, lies close to the heart of leadership and to its danger. Your initiative in breaking the boundaries of your authorization might pay off for your organization or community. In retrospect, it might even be recognized as crucial for success. Along the way, however, you will face resistance and possibly the pain of disciplinary action or other rebukes from senior authority for breaking the rules. You'll be characterized as being out of place, out of turn, or too big for your britches. The toughest problems that groups and communities face are hard precisely because the group or community will not authorize anyone to push them to address those problems. To the contrary, the rules, organizational culture and norms, standard operating procedures, and economic incentives regularly discourage people from facing the hardest questions and making the most difficult choices. In the 1990s, when New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and his police chief, William Bratton, forcefully went after the crime problem in New York City, they were doing exactly what many in the community wanted them to do and what they were implicitly authorized to do. They were expected to relentlessly crack down on crime without forcing the community to accept any trade-offs the police might have to make in terms of police brutality and people's civil liberties. Like many communities, most people in New York City wanted the crime problem to be solved without having to compromise other values. Going with the grain of public expectations, their informal authorization, Giuliani and Bratton brought down the crime rate. Giuliani was rewarded when a satisfied public re-elected him in 1997 by a landslide. However, just before his re-election, on the night of April 9, 1997, some police officers brutalized Abner Louima with a toilet plunger. The incident came to light very quickly, and the ensuing controversy began to focus the broader community on some of the difficult trade-offs they had heretofore been reluctant to make. The issue of racial profiling by police had already been percolating as a signal that an erosion of civil liberties was the price to pay for the reduction in crime. Then, a year and a half later, a young, unarmed West African immigrant, Amadou Diallo, was shot 41 times by four white police officers in a search for a rape suspect that went terribly wrong. Although the four officers in the Diallo incident were acquitted, the incident raised further questions about what had been the social and human costs of the otherwise successful crackdown on crime. Leadership is not the same as authority. It would have been an exercise of leadership and not just authority had Giuliani gone public with the question, how zealous should the police be at the expense of individual liberty and increased brutality. Had the public and Bratton's police department been forced to deal with that trade-off, Giuliani would surely have been attacked by the press, the public, and the police department. However, this also might have provoked people to take responsibility for their choices as citizens. Moreover, it might have led to creative thinking and new options. Solutions that other police departments across America were finding during those very same years, producing dramatic reductions in crime without such high costs. Giuliani and Bratton were not authorized to make their constituencies own the issue and resolve those trade-offs. Of course, exceeding your authority is not, in and of itself, leadership. You may be courageous and you may have vision, but these qualities may have nothing to do with getting people to grapple with hard realities. For example, Colonel Oliver North went beyond his authority in the Iran-Contra affair. Transferring money from Iran arms sales to buy Contra weapons may or may not have had approval from the White House, but it was certainly beyond the authority he had from the Congress. Yet, rather than get U.S. policymakers to tackle the problems posed by Iran and Nicaragua, he tried to engineer secret fixes behind their backs. He failed to lead because he took Congress and the White House off the hook of having to grapple with the issues and make unpopular choices. Rosa Parks, an elderly black woman, also went beyond her authority when she refused to move to the back of a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1955. What distinguishes her from North, however, and made her behavior an act of leadership, was that she and other civil rights leaders used the incident to focus public attention and responsibility on the issue of civil rights, not to avoid it. Her action provoked an outcry of protest that catalyzed the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Congress, the White House, and the American people were provoked to engage the issues, confront deep-seated loyalties, and make new choices. At the heart of danger is loss. Frequently, people who seek to exercise leadership are amazed that their organizations and communities resist. Why should people oppose you when you are helping them change habits, attitudes, and values that only hold them back, when you are doing something good for them? Ron recalls serving as a medical intern at the Kings County Hospital emergency room in Brooklyn, New York, and working with women who had been battered by their boyfriends or husbands. He would ask in various ways, "Why not leave the guy? Surely life can be better for you." And in a variety of ways, they would respond, "Well, my boyfriend gets this way sometimes when he's drinking, but when he's sober, he loves me so much. I've never known anyone love me more sweetly than he does, except when he's going crazy. What would I do alone?" To persuade people to give up the love they know for a love they've never experienced means convincing them to take a leap of faith in themselves and in life. They must experience the loss of a relationship that, despite its problems, provides satisfaction and familiarity, and they will suffer the discomfort of sustained uncertainty about what will replace it. In breaking with the past, there will be historical losses to contend with, too, particularly the feelings of disloyalty to the sources of the values that kept the relationship together. For example, acknowledging the damage from abusive parents earlier in life also means experiencing disloyalty to them. It's hard to sift through and salvage what's valuable from those primary relationships and leave the chaff behind. Even doing that successfully will be experienced somewhat as a disloyalty to those relationships. Moreover, change challenges a person's sense of competence. A battered woman experiences some competence in coping with her familiar setting. Starting anew means going through a sustained period in which she experiences a loss of that competence as she retools her life. Habits, values, and attitudes, even dysfunctional ones, are part of one's identity. To change the way people see and do things is to challenge how they define themselves. Marty experienced this when he got divorced. He had two young children. He had always told himself that he was deeply committed to their welfare, as well as to his own self-actualization. But then he had to choose between the two. He could no longer say truthfully that he was equally committed to both values. His self-identity changed. People's definitions of themselves often involve roles and priorities that others might perceive as self-destructive or as barriers to progress. For some young people, to be a woman is to be a teenage mother. To be a cool man is to take drugs or father a child. For some, to honor one's family is to be a terrorist. For some rich people, to be somebody is to belong to an exclusive club. For some politicians, satisfaction comes from making constituents happy, even if what they need is to be shaken out of their complacency. To give up those conceptions of self may trigger feelings of considerable loss. Habits are hard to give up because they give stability. They are predictable. In going through the pains of adaptive change, there is no guarantee that the result will be an improvement. Smokers understand this. They know that the odds of getting cancer are uncertain, while they know for sure that an enormous source of relaxation and satisfaction will be lost when the cigarettes are gone. But perhaps the deepest influence is that habits, values, and attitudes come from somewhere, and to abandon them means to be disloyal to their origin. Indeed, our deeply held loyalties serve as a keystone in the structure of our identities. Loyalty is a double-edged sword. On one hand, it represents loving attachments to family, team, community, organization, religion, and staying true to these attachments is a great virtue. On the other hand, our loyalties and attachments also represent our bondage and limitations. Intuitively, people play it safe rather than put at risk the love, esteem, and approval of people or institutions they care about. The experience of disloyalty to our deeper attachments is often so painfully unacceptable that we avoid wrestling with them altogether, or do so by acting out. Witness the turmoil of teenagers trying to grow up and decide what to take from home and what to leave behind. Refashioning loyalties is some of the toughest work in life. Perhaps one of the most difficult challenges facing the U.S. civil rights movement in the 1960s was that progress required lots of decent people to abandon attitudes, habits, and values that had been handed down to them by their loving parents and grandparents. To abandon those values felt like abandoning their family. People hold on to ideas as a way of holding on to the person who taught them the ideas. An acquaintance of ours, an African-American woman, once talked to us about her persistent difficulty respecting her friends who saw themselves in a subordinate role because they lived in a society where the mainstream cultural values were white and male. She said that her late father had always told her that she was not subordinate to anyone, that she should never, ever think of herself that way. If she did so now, she added, she would desecrate the memory of her beloved parent. Another friend told us that her mother had always counseled that you can get more done with sugar than vinegar. She now believes that for most of her professional life, she held on to that attitude, to her detriment, and despite much contrary evidence, out of loyalty to her mom. Some of our most deeply held values and ideas come from people we love, a relative, a favored teacher, or a mentor. To discard some part of their teaching may feel like we are diminishing the relationship. But if the first of our two friends were to sift through her father's wisdom, she might discover that he saw and encouraged only two options: sacrifice your self-respect and defer, or never answer to anybody. With further reflection, and if she's lucky to have some help, she might see a third option. One can maintain one's pride and self-worth when taking subordinate roles in authority relationships. Also, there may be a host of ways to challenge authorities respectfully and pursue objectives effectively from below. Our former student, Sylvia, now understands this disloyalty issue very well. She was part of the group of people who put the first public service announcements on television, promoting the use of condoms to protect against AIDS and venereal disease. The ads produced a firestorm of protest from people who believed that they promoted free and irresponsible sex, particularly among young people. Sylvia received death threats, but the protesters' anger also triggered something in her. At the time, she too had teenagers. The values of the protesters were the values that had been handed down to her, and that she in turn espoused to her own children. She was brought up to believe in responsible sex, in the sanctity of sexual relationships, in people honoring each other by their fidelity. And she knew that handing out condoms was, in a way, a short-term technical fix for a much bigger adaptive problem about relationships between men and women, about sexual mores, and about individual responsibility. As Sylvia pushed ahead with the condom campaign, the protesters forced her to experience her own disloyalty to her old values. Upon seeing the television ads, Sylvia's mother felt embarrassed, and her children were confused. Sylvia had to engage in a series of charged and uncomfortable conversations as she clarified her priorities and reconstructed some of the expectations and deep understandings in her relationships with her mother and children. She had made some decisions about which values were more important to her, but getting to the other side of feeling disloyal to her loved ones was a painful process as she moved toward a more deliberate integration of herself. The dangers of exercising leadership derive from the nature of the problems for which leadership is necessary. Adaptive change stimulates resistance because it challenges people's habits, beliefs, and values. It asks them to take a loss, experience uncertainty, and even express disloyalty to people and cultures. Because adaptive change forces people to question and perhaps redefine aspects of their identity, it also challenges their sense of competence. Loss, disloyalty, and feeling incompetent. That's a lot to ask. No wonder people resist. Since the resistance is designed to get you to back away, the various forms may be hard to recognize. You may not see the trap until it is too late. Recognizing these dangers, then, becomes of paramount importance. Chapter 2. The Faces of Danger. The dangers of leadership take many forms. Although each organization and culture has its preferred ways to restore equilibrium when someone upsets the balance, we've noticed four basic forms, with countless ingenious variations. When exercising leadership, you risk getting marginalized, diverted, attacked, or seduced. Regardless of the form, however, the point is the same. When people resist adaptive work, their goal is to shut down those who exercise leadership in order to preserve what they have. Organizations are clever about this. Each of these forms has its subtleties. What makes them effective is that they are not obvious. So people trying to exercise leadership are often pushed aside by surprise. For example, betrayal often comes from places and people you don't expect. Some individuals may not even realize that they are being used to betray you. We know from personal experience that when you are caught up in the action, carrying a cause you believe in, it can be difficult to see the patterns. Over and over again, we have heard stories of people exercising leadership who never saw the danger coming until it was too late to respond. Marginalization. Getting marginalized sometimes takes literal form. In the 1970s, at the old U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, Marty knew a high-ranking, respected, longtime employee named Seth, who began aggressively questioning a new plan designed to fundamentally change the way that HEW delivered social services. The reform was the brainchild and the most important initiative of Seth's boss, the HEW secretary. Seth argued sincerely, but provocatively and repeatedly, raising doubts about the value of something close to the heart of the chief. No one wanted to hear his questions. One day, Seth came into work and found his desk moved into a corridor. His senior colleagues had given most of his responsibilities to others. He believed in his initiatives and questions, and his martyrdom initially appealed to him, but not for long. He soon left the agency, and his disturbing questions were no longer heard. Most of the time, organizations marginalize people less directly. An African-American man tells of his frustration at being part of a management team, but finding his input limited on any issue other than race. A woman, promoted through the civilian side into a senior management role in an organization dominated by military personnel, notices that her colleagues listen to her only when the topic of discussion concerns information technology, her particular field of expertise. Unlike the rest of the senior managers, all men, her views are not taken seriously when she strays beyond her defined field of competence. Many women have told us that in male-dominated organizations, they were encouraged and even told they were hired to carry the gender issue for the whole organization. But they learned painfully that tokenism is a very tricky role to play effectively and costs dearly. When a person or a small group of people embodies an issue and carries it prominently within the organization as a token, then the organization as a whole never has to take on the issue. It can feign the virtue of diversity, but avoid the challenge diverse views pose to its way of doing business. The women, therefore, were unable to move the issue into the heart of the organization. Moreover, when they raised a different perspective on whatever task was at hand, people would roll their eyes and say to themselves, "There she goes again," singing the gender song so regularly, gave the other members of the group a fake excuse not to listen on any other subject. A good example can be found in a mid-1990s diversity initiative of the New England Aquarium. The aquarium opened in 1969 at the leading edge of the revitalization of Boston's waterfront. An instant hit, it quickly attracted about 1 million visitors annually, well in excess of the 600,000-person capacity that its planners had designed. But beginning in the mid-1980s, the Board of Trustees and the senior staff began to be concerned that members of Boston's minority communities were consistently underrepresented among the institution's visitors, employees, and volunteers. Various initiatives directed at people of color during the next decade had not made any noticeable difference. In 1992, a cultural diversity committee of the trustees developed a strategy to attract minority youths as volunteers, which served as the hiring pool for new paid employees. Additions to the aquarium's mission statement in 1992 reflected a new priority on increased diversity in its staff and visitors. The most visible effort toward meeting this new priority was the establishment of a summer intern program for minority interns in the aquarium's education department. Unlike the regular summer interns, these interns were to be paid. The funds came primarily from outside sources that supported summer jobs for students whose families met federal poverty guidelines. As is often the case, this problem had both a technical aspect, how can we get more people of color into the aquarium, and an adaptive aspect, which of our values are keeping people of color away from our door, and are we willing to change them? The nature, design, and location of this program were strong signals that the trustees wanted to address only the technical piece. There was little advance planning for the 7 high school students who showed up for the new intern program in the summer of 1992. Deemed a modest success, the aquarium expanded the program to 30 interns the following summer. But the second year did not go as well. The resulting space crunch created tensions with other volunteers, particularly with the other high school and college interns who resented that the minority interns were being paid for doing the same work they were doing for free. The minority interns had been selected by the funding agencies and had not expressed any particular interest in the aquarium or its work. The staff had issues concerning their behavior, attendance, attitude, and even dress. Although these problems were not unique to the new volunteers, because the group had distinguishing characteristics, they were more visible. Late in the summer of 1993, the aquarium hired into the education department Glenn Williams, an African-American, to take lead responsibility for programs involving inner-city youth. Williams was older than the other educators in the department, the only African-American, and unlike most of his colleagues, without academic training in relevant fields. By the end of 1994, Williams had raised enough outside money to develop two additional programs for inner-city youth to complement the summer jobs program. As Williams' program expanded, so did the tensions with the rest of the aquarium staff, in his education department and elsewhere, whose cooperation he needed if the programs were to be integrated into the institution. As long as he kept the program small and did not interfere with anything else, it was okay. Brick walls could not have done a better job of marginalizing the diversity issue at the aquarium. The minority interns never fit in, and the program failed. Although the trustees earnestly wanted to share their vision of a great aquarium with people of color, they were not particularly interested in changing the aquarium itself, its operations, culture, and ways of doing business, to attract minority visitors. Williams, frustrated, eventually left the aquarium. From his perch at the lower end of the authority structure, he could not redesign the whole institution's diversity response. He had tried, but his complaints had not been addressed. The institution, from the top down, really did not want to face the implications of the deep changes that would have to be undertaken throughout the aquarium to make it accessible in every way to lower economic constituencies and communities of color. Williams had not seen the problems earlier because he believed in the diversity goal. He trusted the supportive and well-intentioned words of the higher-ups, and he was committed to the kids in the internship and other programs. The programs themselves were fine, but the role they were playing in the overall organization served to marginalize the issue, not resolve it. We sometimes collude unwittingly with our marginalizers. A 35-year-old well-established synagogue appointed a young rabbi to be its head rabbi. The retiring rabbi had led the congregation for 32 of those 35 years. At first, everything seemed just perfect for the young man. His predecessor said all the right things, both publicly and privately. He promised to let go. He said he supported the many modernizing changes the new rabbi had talked about instituting during his many interviews for the job. But the new rabbi began to notice some unsettling patterns. When he went to a congregant's house for dinner, his predecessor ate there as well, usually seated next to him. Frequently, people having weddings, bar and bat mitzvahs, and funerals would ask the senior man to share the responsibilities for performing the ceremonies. More important, when he asked his predecessor for advice and counsel on specific changes he wanted to make in the liturgy or ritual, he received a polite but less than enthusiastic response, which was similar to what he heard from senior members of the congregation. So he would hold off. He continued to respond to the elder man with great respect, always deferring, agreeing to the joint activities, postponing changes, and generally, from his point of view, demonstrating a willingness to wait until the path forward was clear. He even passed on speaking engagements that came to the synagogue. He continued to attribute the prolonged transition to an understandable sensitivity to the former rabbi's feelings. After a while, however, the new rabbi realized that he had unwittingly cooperated with a broad effort to suspend the uncertain future and retain the more familiar and comfortable past, represented by the rabbi who had led the congregation for so long. Both the older rabbi and the congregation wanted to avoid as long as possible the hard work of facing the change and the challenges that would inevitably follow the retirement of the elder and the institution of a new spiritual leader for the synagogue. The younger man colluded with the rest of the community in delaying the pain of transition. Eventually, the young man saw the dynamics and his role in it, but by then the congregation had so undermined his authority and credibility that he saw no way to succeed in the role. People in the faction that had pushed hard for hiring him were disillusioned with his go-slow approach, and those who were most resistant to change were invigorated by their success in holding on to what they had. Despairing, the young rabbi resigned. Marginalization often comes in more seductive forms. For example, it may come in the guise of telling you that you are special, sui generis, that you alone represent some important and highly valued idea, with the effect of keeping both you and the idea in a little box. First, the role of special person keeps you from playing a meaningful part on other issues. You are kept from being a generalist. Second, after a while, you are devalued even on your own issue, because it's all people hear you talking about. Third, as with other forms of marginalization like tokenism, the organization can sing its own praises for welcoming unusual people without investigating the relevance and implications of their work to the central mission of the enterprise. If only you can do what you do, then the organization doesn't have to develop and institutionalize your innovation. In several of these examples, the people exercising leadership and getting marginalized did not hold senior positions of authority in their organizations. Marginalization, however, can happen to anybody, including those on top. Authority figures can be sidelined, particularly when they allow themselves to become so identified with an issue that they become the issue. President Lyndon Johnson took the Vietnam War personally. Understandably, he did not want to be the first U.S. president to preside over a defeat. He also did not want his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, to take the heat for the war. And by 1966, anti-war activists were calling it McNamara's war. So Johnson took the heat himself, and soon the war protesters began to chant, "Hey ho, LBJ must go." That was probably the most polite of the slogans they yelled at him. Naively, the protesters substituted defeating Johnson for a much harder problem, namely getting Congress and the public to choose between extracting the country from Vietnam and accepting defeat, or making the huge financial and human sacrifice that might have enabled the country to win the war. Initially, Johnson did not see the danger of taking on himself so much responsibility for escalating the war and letting Congress and the public off the hook for these tough choices. Indeed, he began to take the war as personally as the activists who targeted him. Eventually, however, he realized that the personalization of the war both impeded debate about the conflict and made him ineffective in advancing his extraordinary domestic agenda. By joining the orchestra, he had given up his baton. To his credit, he decided to step down from the presidency rather than seek re-election in 1968. Personalization tends toward marginalization. Embodying an issue may be a necessary, though risky, strategy, particularly for people leading without authority. However, for people in senior authority positions, embodying the issue can be even more perilous. Authorities commonly have to represent a variety of constituents. They rarely can afford to embody one issue. They need to keep their hands free so they can orchestrate conflicts rather than become the object of conflict. And as we will discuss later, embodying an issue in your authority role ties your survival, not just your success, to that of the issue. That's a dangerous platform on which to stand. Diversion. Another time-honored way to push people aside is to divert them. There are many ways in which communities and organizations will consciously or subconsciously try to make you lose focus. They do this sometimes by broadening your agenda, sometimes by overwhelming it, but always with a seemingly logical reason for disrupting your game plan. Opponents of the Vietnam War enticed Martin Luther King Jr. into expanding his agenda from civil rights to the war. Of course, they had a rationale for his doing so. Widening his agenda appealed not only to King's moral convictions, but also perhaps to his own self-importance and prowess, fueled legitimately by the enormous progress made on civil rights. But as hard as the civil rights struggle had been in the South, some of the hardest issues, namely ending racial intolerance in the North, were yet to be addressed. Diverting King's attention to the Vietnam War had the dual effect of generating even greater solidarity with Northern liberals, who felt moral anti-war outrage, without challenging them personally. He might have strained those relationships had he brought the civil rights movement to their communities, schools, law firms, and corporations. Their lives would have been disrupted, their values questioned, and their behaviors and practices scrutinized. They would have been on television either defending their way of life or denouncing it in front of their friends and neighbors. King turned his attention to opposing the Vietnam War with terrible results. His core constituents, Southern black people, were not with him. They knew that too much work still lay ahead in the South as well as in the North. Not only did King achieve little success on the Vietnam War issue, but by losing his focus, he became less available to lead the movement beyond establishing the foundations of equality, like voting rights. Facing complex issues in northern cities and ghettos, the movement bogged down. Some people are promoted or given new, glamorous responsibilities as a way of sidetracking their agenda. Whenever you get an unexpected promotion, or when some fun or important tasks are added to your current role, pause and ask yourself, do I represent some disquieting issue from which the organization is moving to divert me and itself from addressing? We know a cantankerous newspaper columnist who found herself promoted to an editor's position, as much to silence her provocative writing as to make use of her editing skills. We also know a primary school principal in the poorest community in her Missouri school district, whose extraordinary success with students and parents generated sufficient disturbance among some teachers, whom she rode pretty hard, that the school superintendent promoted her to district headquarters to serve as a consultant. He even touted his ingenuity in finding a way to get her out of the primary school she had spent 20 years working to transform, with the goal of restoring order and calm to his school system. Corporate management will sometimes calm the waters by promoting union rabble-rousers into exempt positions in the hope that the next generation of union leadership will be more cooperative. People in top authority positions can easily be diverted by getting lost in other people's demands and programmatic details. Our friend Elizabeth was about to achieve a long-time ambition to become head of the state human services agency with a multi-billion-dollar budget, thousands of employees, and the well-being of hundreds of thousands of people under her charge. She yearned for the job because, having watched the agency for years, she had a long list of initiatives and reforms that she thought would make a difference. She understood that she was going to upset some people wedded to the current system, but with courage and strength, she felt confident that she could see change through. She did not, however, take stock of two important dynamics. First, she knew her various constituencies, both inside and outside the agency, disagreed deeply among themselves on the size, scope, and delivery systems for various health and welfare programs. But she did not realize that they agreed on one thing, namely that Elizabeth should focus on their collective set of issues, whatever they were, rather than on her own or anyone else's. And second, she didn't understand that they could squash her agenda more easily by overwhelming her with demands and details than by fighting her head-on. As she was about to take the job, Marty suggested that they have lunch in 6 months to see how she was progressing on the list of things she wanted to accomplish. Then she charged off into the fray. The lunch date came. Elizabeth looked frustrated. "What happened?" Marty asked. "It's the most amazing thing," she replied. "I've never been so busy. My appointment calendar is full, and each meeting is important. Many are contentious. I am working more hours than I ever did before. I'm exhausted at the end of every day. I take work home on the weekend. But I have barely begun to work on my agenda. I finally realized that since I've been in the job, I've only seen 100 or so people. It's as if they all got together, whatever their differences, and agreed to keep me so busy with their lists that I would never get to anything on my list." Known as a workaholic, Elizabeth is extremely conscientious. She takes pride in answering her phone calls and staying in touch with her constituencies, even those who disagree with her. She enjoys intense policy debates. The folks in the human services world knew that. She was right. They had gotten together, albeit not in a literal sense. Warren Bennis calls it the unconscious conspiracy to take you off your game plan. Diversion by inbox stuffing kept Elizabeth's eyes off the ball. It kept her immersed in the perspectives, problems, and infighting that had bedeviled others for years. The technique worked. It was much more effective than if folks had tried to battle her directly on her own issues. Attack. Attacking you personally is another tried-and-true method of neutralizing your message. Whatever the form of the attack, if the attackers can turn the subject of the conversation from the issue you are advancing to your character or style, or even to the attack itself, it will have succeeded in submerging the issue. Attention, the currency of leadership, gets wasted. If you can't draw people's attention to the issues that matter, then how can you lead them in the right direction or mobilize any progress? You have probably been attacked in one form or another. Perhaps you've been criticized for your style of communication. Too abrasive or too gentle, too aggressive or too quiet, too conflictive or too conciliatory, too cold or too warm. In any case, we doubt that anyone ever criticizes your character or your style when you're giving them good news or passing out big checks. For the most part, people criticize you when they don't like the message. But rather than focus on the content of your message, taking issue with its merits, they frequently find it more effective to discredit you. Of course, you may be giving them opportunities to do so. Surely every one of us can continue to improve our style and our self-discipline. The point is not that you are blameless, but that the blame is largely misplaced in order to draw attention away from the message itself. The most obvious form of a diverting attack is physical. You might remember the protests at the World Trade Organization, WTO, meeting in Seattle, Washington, in the fall of 1999. The protesters were interested in raising issues about WTO policies and their impacts on poor people, on jobs in the United States, and on the environment. The local law enforcement officials were interested in protecting the security of the delegates and their meeting. The WTO delegates were interested in keeping the debate focused on their concerns and not on the protesters' agenda. Whether intentional or not, the physical contact between the police and the protesters had the effect of making the fight, not the issues, the focus of public attention. The squabbles between protesters and police took the protesters' agenda out of the news. People become easily diverted by physical attack. It's full of drama. It hurts. Some people are repulsed by it. Some are drawn to it in a macabre kind of way. Whatever the reaction, the spectacle of violence is effective in moving people away from any underlying, deeply troubling issues. For example, an angry outburst that turns physical in a family immediately replaces the primary issues with the issue of the violence itself. The violent person loses legitimacy for his or her perspective and unwittingly colludes with the offended parties in sabotaging the discussion of his or her views. In the 2000 presidential election, an unplanned personal attack created diversionary news. In an aside to his running mate Dick Cheney, George W. Bush used a vulgarity to describe Adam Clymer, a longtime New York Times political reporter. Bush had not realized that the microphones were on, and he felt embarrassed when his remark was overheard. The press attacked Bush, using the incident to raise issues about his character. No one bothered to analyze whether Bush was onto something, whether Clymer's articles had been fair and responsible, or had been biased in favor of the Democratic nominee. And Bush, by making it personal, unwittingly served up the distraction and diminished his capacity to raise the issue of journalistic bias. Assassinations, like those of Yitzhak Rabin and Anwar Sadat, are the most extreme examples of a silencing attack as a way of stopping the voices of difficult realities. Both assassinations set back the cause of peace in the Middle East, delaying the day when people would have to experience loss of land and disloyalty to their ancestors in order to thrive in today's interdependent world. Fortunately, your opponents, those people most disturbed by your message, are far more likely to use verbal rather than physical attacks. The attacks may go after your character, your competence, or your family, or may simply distort and misrepresent your views. They will come in whatever form your opponents think will work. Through trial and error, they will find your Achilles heel. They will come at you wherever you are most vulnerable. In politics, people frequently finger-point at character to deflect attention from the issues. For much of Bill Clinton's 8 years in the White House, his ideological opponents came after him not on the issues, but on his character. They found an obvious Clinton vulnerability. As you know, he provided them with ammunition. The personal attacks on him succeeded considerably in diverting him from his policy agenda. It's quite interesting that the conservatives were not threatened by all of his agenda. Quite to the contrary, Clinton threatened them because some of his agenda was theirs. Clinton was stealing their issues, such as welfare reform and the balanced budget. And if he succeeded, his leverage to promote the detested aspects of his agenda would increase substantially. The function of attacking Clinton on character was no different than the function of attacking Clarence Thomas on character during his hearings for confirmation to the U.S. Supreme Court. Opponents went after him personally because they had great difficulty defeating his nomination on the issues. Thomas did not fit the mold of an easy-to-oppose conservative judicial nominee. He was an African-American with not much of a paper trail documenting his judicial philosophy or political ideology. He was no easy target like G. Harold Carswell, the intellectually, professionally, and judicially undistinguished Southern conservative whom Richard Nixon nominated to the Supreme Court in 1970. He was not even as vulnerable as Robert Bork, Ronald Reagan's unsuccessful 1987 nominee, who had written extensively and whose published views were anathema to many members of the U.S. Senate. But like Clinton, Thomas had somehow made himself vulnerable to attacks on his character, particularly the sexual harassment charges from Anita Hill and others. Attacks may take the form of misrepresentation. Early in his tenure, President Bill Clinton nominated Lonnie Guinier to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. She enjoyed a reputation as a brilliant law school professor, a trusted friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and a creative thinker. She believed strongly in government action to ensure individual rights, and she would likely have made the Civil Rights Division a visible and aggressive activist agency. However, a search of her writings found a Law Review article in which she analyzed the issue of political representation. In fact, her notion of proportional representation was not a new or crazy idea. In political theory, her argument had both respectability and a long history, similar to arguments about the principles upon which voting district lines should be drawn. Moreover, the argument that drew attack represented only one thought in an article full of ideas, and it appeared in one Law Review article by a woman who had written several. But focusing on it provided an opportunity for her opponents to label her the quota queen. The misrepresentation placed Clinton in a tough position. He could have taken on the difficult task of trying to explain that the clever, memorable, and politically unacceptable label "quota queen" was a distortion, and then draw the focus back to the real issue. The